Hello, and welcome to Medical Progress Today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard, and I'm the director and senior fellow of the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. Our guest today is Mark Booten, executive vice president and chief operating officer of the National Health Council, an umbrella group of patient advocacy groups that provides a united voice for more than 133 million people with chronic diseases and disabilities, as well as their family caregivers. We're talking to Mark today about the upcoming fifth reauthorization of the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, and his congressional testimony on that topic that he delivered earlier this month. Mark, thanks for taking some time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Paul.
Mark, I think you've developed a very important and very powerful framework for analyzing and understanding the FDA decision-making process, and particularly this concept that you've spoken about a few times, most recently in your testimony, that the FDA has two stakeholder groups, two important stakeholder groups that it has in mind when it's making its decisions, and that's patients and caregivers. Could you talk for just a few minutes about what you're trying to convey through this distinction, why you think it's important, and how, for instance, you think it should impact regulatory review decisions that affect how the FDA sees different drug risks and benefits?
Sure. Thank you. We sort of look at them as essentially opposite ends of the same spectrum. And by that, what I mean is that we look at people with chronic disease and disabilities and for shorthand, refer to them as patients. And on the other end of the spectrum, we look at people without chronic disease or disabilities and refer to them sort of in the shorthand as consumers. And while they really are part of the same stakeholder group, they have very similar issues and concerns in some respects, but they also have very, very different perspectives on other issues. And the way I like to frame it is this. Think of yourself as somebody who might have hay fever, mild hay fever in the springtime. There are many over-the-counter products. There are some prescription drug products that you could use to treat that hay fever. Your tolerance for a new product that has a substantial risk is probably pretty low. So imagine a new product comes out to treat hay fever, and it warns you that you're going to have side effects of really bad headaches, nausea, rash, perhaps a few other negative consequences. You're probably not going to be interested in taking that product. It's not something you're willing to tolerate given the existence of other treatments, both over-the-counter and prescription. But imagine for a moment that you are having difficulty with your stomach and you go to the doctor. And after some testing, it turns out you have pancreatic cancer and you're told you have 11 months to live. Your interest in a new treatment is going to be high, especially if it can prolong your life. You might find a treatment that comes to market and they're going to tell you, well, you know what? It's going to cause headaches, skin rash, nausea, all the same side effects of that potential new treatment for hay fever. And you're probably going to be very interested in taking that product if it will extend your life by a year or two. The interesting challenge you have here is that you can be a consumer and a patient at the same time. But your perspective on the sort of benefits you would like, as well as the kinds of risks that you'd be willing to accept, change dramatically. And so we think the FDA has been in a challenging position because often they're looking at products through the lens of the public. And the public obviously includes both patients and consumers. And we've taken the perspective, and I think FDA now shares that perspective, that you really have to look at the product through the eyes of the intended user and make sure that you're assessing the benefits and risk of that product and making your approval decisions based on the end user's tolerance and values around benefit risk.
And I think that the issue that you're pointing out is also complicated by the fact that the media or members of Congress who look at these issues, and we can talk for a minute about what happens when these safety problems pop up, but they're approaching them because most people, thankfully, are healthy most of the time. And so they approach them as consumers rather than patients and see them through that lens. And that can be not the right lens, based on what you've explained, for understanding the problems or issues that are raised for specific products for specific diseases.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's interesting. We've had the opportunity to meet with staff on Capitol Hill regarding this issue, and I'm always struck that they're typically so much younger than I am. there are often people that have never taken a medicine to treat a chronic condition.
And funnily enough, they seem to keep getting younger every year.
I know. It's frightening, right? When you meet with these people, they're not looking through the lens of somebody with Parkinson's or pancreatic cancer or lupus. They're looking at the issue through the lens of somebody who doesn't have a serious life-threatening condition. And as a result, their tolerance for risk is virtually zero. And you see the same thing in the media. And you find this resistance and emphasis and focus on safety. But the reality is, if you're living with a chronic condition, you're also dying of that chronic condition. And a distinction I should have made earlier in the discussion of a patient and a consumer, a patient is a person who has a chronic condition. They're going to use the healthcare system to manage their daily life, and they're going to do that until they die. Whereas a consumer is only going to engage the health system as they need to for ad hoc events, perhaps an acute event, but not on an ongoing basis. And so their perception of benefit and risk and their willingness to accept risk is entirely different. And that makes perfect sense. And I think we in the patient community would say, when you're dealing with a patient product, you know, a treatment for pancreatic cancer, our desire and willingness to take a risk is extremely high. But our desire or willingness to take a risk for a new medicine for hay fever or to grow our eyelashes longer is extremely low.
I think that that's absolutely right. Although I think there's also another interesting little wrinkle, which is, you know, with some products that we've been taking for many years and many consumers take without a second thought, like Tylenol, which can have severe effects for liver toxicity if they're taken in too high a dosage, or even rare allergic reactions to aspirin from Reye syndrome that do in fact harm and sometimes kill people. I think that it also depends on what our comfort level with that product is and the frequency that we pay attention to it. So products that might come to the market today, if Tylenol came to the market today, or maybe even aspirin, would face perhaps a different reception from the FDA than they did originally when they came to market, just because we're so used to them now and we take those relatively small risks for granted.
I think that's true, and that's actually a good message for consumers or the general public to really understand that there really no product has no risk, and how we deal with that and accept it is really a challenge.
And I think that's a nice segue to move that into something you've recommended, which is, as part of these the PDUFA 5 renegotiations, we'll call them, that the agency develop and implement what you've called a qualitative plan to integrate quote, a benefit-risk framework into the drug review process that places the drug's intended recipient into the equation. And you hope that this would be developed with robust input from patients and healthcare consumers, and it would, you say, provide context to the drug review process. What do you mean by context?
Well, context actually allows the FDA to really focus in, again, on the end user and allow for the determination to be based around the end user. Right now, and actually I should sort of step back, because the context is sort of within the framework that we're proposing has multiple meanings, but the opportunity here is to really get a framework that everybody agrees to into place. One of the things that is kind of shocking to us in the patient community is that no system, including the FDA or Europe or any other country, has a clear, identified framework for assessing benefit risk. And what happens is a group of reviewers will assess it, but it's not something that is written down in a framework. It's not consistently used. There's no predictability. There's no ability to have a conversation about what happened, because it's really done in the minds of the reviewers. And as a result, if there's disagreement over elements of the analysis, you can't even have a conversation on it, because you don't know what the specific analysis was. So the challenge we have here is, how do we ensure that we create a framework that is very clearly identified, that provides weight to the different measures you want to address based on the end user, that really helps you identify where the evidence is certain, where it's uncertain, how you address it in the therapeutic context, and then how do you make this work for both patients and consumers? To the extent you have a framework that starts to look at the severity of the condition, whether it's an unmet medical need, what are the clinical benefits, what are the known risks, can those risks be managed?
And what that patient group's tolerance for risk is.
Exactly. And so we think you can create a framework that addresses these issues in a consistent way that can be applied to multiple products, but allow you to put it into the context of the end user. So is it a treatment for Parkinson's, or is it a medicine that's going to grow your eyelashes longer? And once you have that, you can assign the weights differently.
Or perhaps even for products for diabetes or arthritis or obesity that span the continuum that you've discussed of between consumers and patients, what the variance tolerance is for people who use those products, what the context is, and then perhaps how physicians and the patients or consumers who are using those products should understand the risks and the benefits that they're facing in a more nuanced way that might address concerns that both the FDA and then patients and consumers might have about a product. Because there is, you know, as you've talked about quite a bit, even individual patients will vary in their tolerances for risk or their preferences for certain benefits over other benefits.
I think that's absolutely right. You really have to look at it as a spectrum. And it's easier to explain the concept by comparing somebody with pancreatic cancer and somebody with hay fever. But the reality is, whatever the condition you're talking about, it falls somewhere in between those two extremes. Certainly somebody with heart disease with multiple treatments has less tolerance for risk than somebody with a deadly form of cancer or Alzheimer's disease, for example. So you really have to identify that therapeutic context or therapeutic indication, and that frames your context for using this framework and allows you to really get it right for the audience. But because you would have a consistent framework, you would have a mechanism for patients, consumers, the FDA, industry, to have a meaningful dialogue or conversation to say, here's what where I think you got it right, here's where I disagree, and here's why. Right now, you can't even have a meaningful conversation because there's no structure.
Well, and the other thing I think that this points out, although this moves us on to the next issue I'd like to talk to you about conflict of interest, is even if you're looking at, say, one advisory committee meeting on one day about one particular product and what that vote tells you about that product, you could argue that a different set of equally qualified experts, but perhaps with a different perspective or patient representatives, would come to a different understanding of that product. And I think it gets to the fact that until you develop some more framework, qualitative or quantitative, that gives you that kind of context and issue about what exact risks, what benefits, what types of patients we're talking about, you are looking at a situation where, you know, you had one meeting or one discussion that tells you something about one meeting or one discussion rather than about what the real context is you're operating in.
I think that's true, and you sort of remind me of some efforts that have gone on at FDA where you actually bring in patients outside of the advisory committee and outside of the review process just to talk about what is important to them in treatment in light of their condition. And so often what we find is people make assumptions about what we think is important, and in many cases they get it wrong. And one example I'll just give, psoriasis. For a long time, people thought that the most important thing to people with psoriasis was the size of the lesion on their skin. But the reality is, when you speak with people with psoriasis, they'll tell you that the two most important things to them, or really the most important thing, is the location of the lesion. Is it on their face, or is it near a joint and impacting mobility? You really have to speak to the person who is going to end up using the product and figure out what is important to them and assess your analysis on whether or not you're going to approve the drug in that context.
And then to talk about the advisory committee issue, you've raised this, even people at the FDA, I know Janet Woodcock has raised this and said it's becoming increasingly difficult for the agency to find very qualified experts to staff its review committees, particularly when we're talking about the incidence of diseases that are rare diseases. So there may be four or five experts in the world. Of course, if you're looking at that, every company who's developing a product for that disease is going to want to talk to and work with those people, and then they're automatically going to be conflicted out of what are apparently, I think, fairly stringent conflict of interest guidelines now in place at the FDA. What do you think about that issue, and how can we address it to still, you know, get the kind of transparency that we want from the process, but get the best advice at the same time?
Yeah, it's a really challenging issue, and I think the complexity has been thrust upon the FDA, and I think FDA is trying to figure out how to deal with this issue. Increasingly, you're seeing medicines that treat smaller populations, and as a result, there are smaller groups with the expertise on how to address them. You have a situation where the FDA is now trying to implement 5 different legal schemes on conflict of interest, including the fact that in the last authorization of PDUFA, they were told by Congress that they had to reduce the number of waivers that they could give. And it's led FDA into a place where it's taking a very restrictive approach in order to meet the new waiver reduction requirement. And as a result, you're finding that even for what are called essential experts, people that are needed by the advisory committee in order to make a decision, if they have a potential conflict, and a potential conflict could be that they had a prior arrangement with a pharmaceutical company, not on the compound we're talking about for purposes of approval, but that potential conflict would mean that the FDA would have to look for an alternative expert with the same skill set. And as a result of that, they're finding it incredibly difficult to find qualified participants. Their own numbers say there are about 25% of the seats on the advisory committees are vacant, and it's leading, by their own admission, to delays in approvals of products.
And the review rate, I think it was higher, the absence rate was higher, I think, for some specific review committees. It was up 30% for one that I read about.
That's right. And so I think the challenge is how do we address this in a way that is more balanced? And I think this is difficult because it will require congressional action. When we started to think about this, I have to acknowledge we don't have a specific proposal or solution yet. But the reality is we need to have a process that ensures transparency, that ensures the credibility of this process. But we can't be in a situation where the process is so strident that you can't get the right experts to the table.
And thinking off the top of my head here, I would think that one element that perhaps we should think about in this area is not so much worrying about who worked with whom, although we should all disclose that, but then ensuring that there's a real diversity of opinion on panels so that there's no one dominant viewpoint and you get a real exchange of views so that any potential concerns would be vitiated by having somebody who had just a different perspective on the panel.
There's a fair amount of research to that point that if you have all the divergent perspectives, you do tend to get to a point where all the issues are addressed. They're highlighted, they become visible, and you tend to get very good decisions. And I think there is a challenge of being transparent and managing conflicts, but I think over the last several years, there's been a perspective of any potential conflict should somehow preclude your participation. And the reality is you can have even an existing conflict that can be managed in a way that can allow the quality of your insights to inform, but you really have to focus in on managing the conflict or reducing its impact on a negative outcome. And I think there are ways to do that, but right now the FDA is just not in a position where it can.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, I think the topic of our discussion today have revealed that what we need to do to bring to this issue is lots of nuance in how we're understanding the distinctions between patients and consumers for particular products that are going through the review process. And then finally, you know, bringing the right degree of expertise to the agency that they can make the best decisions possible. That will add yet more nuance and complexity into the process. At the end of the day, that gives patients and physicians more tools to make better decisions. Mark, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.